I'm Steve Edwins.
And David Trigested.
And I believe that I have been chosen moderator of this group because essentially I have said everything I have to say tonight. And I can turn it over to these two very articulate gentlemen who have been my inspiration for what you just experienced. Anybody want, what's the feeling? Shall we launch into our statements, or does anyone want to?
Let's let them decide.
Talk, okay. Ask questions. What's your feeling? Tom, Carol. Carol would like to go back.
Was that a statement or a question?
take it away, Tom.
I was attempting to say that I'd like to hear comments about the message. What are you going to say?
I'd like to do it first. That's a good idea. Then I'll ask my question.
Okay. So the floor is open for comments about Vespers or questions about it or whatever you'd like to ask, tell us about.
I wanted to applaud, very much so. That was my feeling. It was enthralling. It was very moving, but I also wanted to applaud.
Sylvia, that's lovely of you to say, because what it means to me is that you were kinetically involved, that the movement of what you saw got through your kinesthetic sense, and your body wanted to respond in movement fashion, which is why we applaud at the end of concerts. And it's an interesting challenge to the church. There are those churches that applaud. And I have been places where, I mean, there are times when I think silence is the perfect response. And I think there are alternatives to applause that is audible. I think that, you know, some churches will do something like this. Or I think the most beautiful applause would be a silent standing ovation. I'd love to get one of those. A silent standing ovation. And I have seen that happen where people have been so, I realize I'm getting into an ego thing here, but there are various ways of handling that.
I guess we could talk about why some churches don't feel comfortable applauding. That might be worth bringing up at some point.
May we hand the mic? Let's hand the mic to Carol.
Is there an oxygen bottle?
We nearly had a discussion in community about applauding or not applauding. Yeah. We nearly did, but off to another time.
Well, yeah, we did, and there the concern was, why do we applaud for children's vespers, and that can be, how should put it, kind of condescending. Kids. But my response is, I'm glad you didn't applaud. And I was, the people next to me were wanting to applaud. I was saying, no, don't. Because that to me suggests that then the whole experience was up there. It was a performance that we applaud, that we, rather than if we felt involved in it, which, you know, some people may not have felt very involved. There wasn't much for us to do in the tradition of good liturgy. But if we felt involved, then I bet we wouldn't applaud.
I would question that. I applauded a play, but I'm definitely involved in it. I applauded a musical concert, but I'm involved in it. It's not just something up there.
See, I think, Carol, this goes back to what I was saying to Sylvia, that you were involved. I mean, I even saw you involved, because I could get you, I could watch you up here, and...
But I didn't want to applaud. So
that's fine. I mean, this is the problem, of course. Some people have a physical response of needing to applaud, and there's been the statement made by some people who work in liturgical dance, there is that if we've done our job well, and this was a performance-oriented Vespers, if we've done our job well, you do get involved in the way you get involved when you are in a concert hall where applause is allowed. Sometimes, it's been said that if the church doesn't want applause, then it would be useful within the framework of the service to allow for the congregation to get up right away and sing a very uplifting song that would allow for some of that physical energy to be released. But I can understand that. I mean, there are times when I am at a concert and I wish people really wouldn't applaud. Steve, you had things you wanted to say about.
Well, I guess in general terms, applause is one way that people want to respond. If they're involved, they want to respond. It's not a blank. It's not necessarily an automatic thing. The judgment about which kind of response is appropriate in the setting is one that a community has to figure out among its members, you know, what the permission level are for different types of response for different kinds of things. I mean, there are funerals and there are weddings and there are many of different situations, and maybe we just haven't exercised a lot of vocabulary because we do so little of this that we don't know how to
of applause.
Respond.
What is the point of clapping, though?
I think it's really a release of energy. And there are cultures where it's perfectly appropriate to throw rotten tamales as a response.
In Baptist churches, people are responding all the time with what they feel appropriate. Mm-hmm. Amen. Mm-hmm. Hallelujah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Lord.
Yeah. But
I can remember one time when I was in college and I sang in the St. Olaf choir, and we sang in a big church. And we finished a particularly rousing version of praise to the Lord, and no one applauded. And Dr. Chris Johnson turned around and he said to the audience that in the Bible it says, you know, you can clap your hands and so on and so on. He quoted scripture. In other words, he gave them permission to applaud, and it seemed a release to them, and they applauded. But there have been other times when I've been to a choir concert when they've finished a lovely, quiet, contemplative piece, mm-hmm. and applause seemed obtrusive. Mm-hmm. And people applauded, and I couldn't. I just sat with my hands in my lap. It wasn't appropriate in my estimation. So, but it certainly is an individual thing.
Carol, I agree with you about the distancing. I mean, I certainly think that can happen, and I think that it has happened in our concert halls, where people applaud whether they enjoy something or not. They think that it's an important response. I mean, you just do it. It's just the appropriate thing. I have been to a church for some time that applauds at everything. Everything. And the applause means nothing. And it is a distancing in that church. I'm very clear about that. That people are somehow so in need of letting stuff out that they're not even listening to what's happening. They're just waiting for that moment to let something out.
Just automatic response,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Rather than.
Mm-hmm.
My question would be, there again, the purpose of applause is often an acknowledgement of the performer's expertise or whatever. And then the question is, it's a worship service, so one thing I always tried to remember when I was in choir, or one thing that was important to me when I was in choir, was that I was not performing per se, but I was engaging in an act of worship. And in an act of worship, I would see myself as praising God, and therefore wouldn't necessarily, I wouldn't feel it appropriate to be acknowledged for my act, because that would take away from the giving I was trying to do to God. And that's a reason why I don't think people should be afraid to applaud, but I think you have to be very careful when you do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that applause is really, really founded in our physical kinesthetic responses. And there, again, we're in a very curious relationship to worship. Traditionally, we have not allowed for those responses. And I personally believe that we can worship in that way as well as we can in silence and stillness. One of the issues, if any of you all have picked up this book and looked at it, Performers, Priest, and Prophet, that Judith Rock discusses is the whole matter of our not having really brought the intuitive side of the human being into the worship situation as much as we really need to, that really for centuries now that has been eliminated from our worship environment. And as she particularly approaches this from the standpoint of the feminist movement and women coming into leadership roles in the church, and relates creativity and intuition to female, though she really looks for a world when we balance masculine and feminine in each one of us. And she suggests that the use of performance can really get under some of those barriers that we have and can engage us at that intuitive level. And that there is a way in which we can begin to re-embody the word. And I think that's a very fascinating possibility for us to look at.
One reason we wanted to do this, and it's a planning of it, went through a lot of evolution about exactly
yes.
what to do, is because it is a kind of a basic human ritual. And these intuitive acts and activities and motions have been slowly kind of cut out of worship over the centuries. In the early church, there's evidence that there was a lot of kind of festivity and a lot of joyful crying. And the emotional side was still there. If you want to get real theoretical about it, like the way we talk about drama and other things, you could say that there are these two tensions in life, as in drama, of kind of the rational and the emotional, or the Apollonian and the Dionysian kind of spirits. Both have to be there. And we've kind of clipped away over the centuries the Dionysian. In part, we've been afraid of it. You know, we've been afraid of love feasts and afraid of being over-emotional. Look how scared most of us are in kind of traditional churches of the holy rollers, you know. And probably the shakers even, but they don't do much shaking anymore.
There
are
not many of them. Not many. Yeah.
Even the Quakers started out in a tradition of really having physical expression of the spirit. And I think maybe we have, over the ages, wrongly even took, you know, Paul's message to the Corinthians and others, because we haven't, you know, figured out that context until recently. That he was talking about wild excesses. He wasn't trying to perhaps trim down any exuberance from worship. People were leaving others out of the party and were being exclusive and were abusing the sacraments in that respect. But for some reason we've have to rediscover, I believe, kind of our innate symbolism and metaphorical life, and bring it back into the worship scene, because it expresses our whole spirit. And that's one reason I think our worship services sometimes are accused of being dead, or we look for alternative liturgies. It's because we've forgotten how they're founded in our basic ritual life. We're all creatures of ritual. And I had some statements about ritual that I'll introduce
right
at the appropriate
now.
Time, but I was reading last night a little piece by Philip Wheelwright, who said that ritual is essentially when two or three children start avoiding the cracks on a sidewalk. We all express our being, and we express our roles through our activities in space and time. That's our life. And since ritual is the dance of life, and if you look at this group, for instance, where we are, I mean, ritual is what orders this village. You've got fire rituals, you've got eating rituals, you have cooking rituals, you have wood cutting rituals, you have snow plowing rituals. I mean, it's an incredible ritual system. And these fundamental activities, from brushing our teeth to washing, which is what we dealt with tonight.
We didn't put brushing our teeth in
there. I forgot that. It was a little too, maybe too earthy, huh?
I didn't even think about it.
those activities are our inner being, and we can't forget about those, because that really is what drives the essences of worship, I think, is linking together our ceremonial text and music with the basic spiritual symbols that have come out over the ages. So washing was used for that purpose. Washing, in a sense, in this thing tonight, as you most likely observed, dealt mostly with a servanthood role in washing, and simply the experience of water as an element and people engaged with each other. We did not go into the whole kind of other water symbolism of baptism and renewal and things of that sort. We thought that was maybe a little too conceptual and maybe not as elemental as simply the acts of washing.
Can I ask a question, Steve? What did you all read in this group over here, in the snow group? What did you think they were doing besides playing in snow?
Thought they were having fun.
That was, as a matter of fact, an effort to bring into the thing, into the whole spectrum, a hint of baptism. And it was deliberately left very, very abstract. But that was what was going on over there, besides the snow. And there were a few hints, the sprinkling of the snow and the wiping across the brow, which probably at some level you all read and just are not articulating, because we don't always articulate those things with our left brain. Sorry.
Well, plus there was permission to laugh there. I don't know if it was intended, but they were having a good time.
And is baptism a time not to have a good time? Here.
No, not at all. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No.
One of the observations I've made in processing through what I'm used, quote-unquote, used to in a worship service, and some of the movement, that kind of thing, and even the architectural kinds of thing, and I wonder if it affects with the applause, because I would not have been comfortable applauding at that point. To me, it seemed more responsive to the situation to be quiet. I thought, why am I uncomfortable with the applauding? Well, it seems like then I'm giving the praise to the performer rather than to God. And I was wondering if the reason that I feel that way is when you take the bus type of architecture and you've got a raised platform and that's the chancel, and we're used to doing the observing, and so if we were to applaud, it would seem more directed towards that chancel rather than as a response to whatever was going on. As we lower that and we bring that to the center, and people become more involved, it seems more than natural that both movement would get involved a lot more easily, and the response of clapping or whatever that might be would be more natural. You know?
And we would feel the interaction among ourselves.
That's right.
Rather than being a sole individual relating to something on stage.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the applause wouldn't be so much as thank you for a good job or for a performance, as it is, in a sense, thanking God for the gift, that pointed us to Christ, or something like that.
And we've all been through this experience together, and we kind of praise that, gee, this was neat, you know.
Rather than being applauding, it's just being a part of.
I think it's a response of delight. I don't know, which is why sometimes that applause doesn't seem appropriate even if one is moved. The response is to be silent.
And if God is seen as the creator, creation is a delightful thing and a playful thing and can engage us. And as Steve has been talking all week, color and light.
What do you think are some of the movement responses that are appropriate for different types of experience?
Well, okay. Before I answer that, I would say that the reason I didn't applaud is I didn't know if it was the end or not. I don't want to look stupid and start clapping, and then all of a sudden the tape comes back on, they finish it off with the scripture, another scripture. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen.
Well, the Baptists in church don't wait till the end to...
Yeah, well, they're not as self-conscious as that.
Yeah, I guess not. Mm-hmm.
Well, we did really try to find a way to end it. We thought that Lisa's bow would really tell you that it was over.
Depending on what you're looking at, I guess.
Well, I think it was okay for people to sit for a while.
There's no reason to just rush.
It's my car before it goes downstairs.
There was something else that happened with not only the marvelous use of the cloth, but the fact that we, who had been surrounding all of you, were now being surrounded by those whom we had surrounded.
Do you know, that hadn't even occurred to me.
And the reciprocity there
that
was built in was just so neat.
Inside than outside.
How lovely. That was not anything I was aware of.
And then the way that the sprinkling restated what was happening up there. It was just wonderful. Plus, we could feel the wind. I could feel lots of wind.
You didn't get any water?
Oh, yes. I took my glasses off.
we wanted the air to move and the water to hit people on their heads.
Were any of you offended by the water hitting you?
That's disappointing because I didn't get as far as either.
Oh. I had one moment of absolute horror when I realized, and I realized this before we did the thing, that the water that was being sprinkled on the congregation was the water in which Catherine's feet were bathed. Catherine, of course, had very clean feet. She'd been through rather a lot of foot washing today.
I was reading the other night about an ancient Peruvian belief that they believe that it rained because a Peruvian goddess was up in the clouds with the pitcher and would dip into the water in the clouds and pour it over the side. We could have done that, you know, around here.
Next time, Tom. Toothbrushing and pouring down water.
Actually, that's kind of, I said that before, that's kind of neat to use that water for the blessing too.
I think so.
The water of servanthood.
Exactly, exactly.
It's been blessed with her feet.
The guy I was sitting next to, I think he's the business manager, is he Ken?
Kent.
We were sitting over in this corner, and to me the funniest thing that happened during the service was when he saw her starting to sprinkle the water, and he was very calmly, coolly took his
That was an appropriate movement response, Steve. Well, I think Steve has raised an interesting question.
I'm sure Robert did too. We're accustomed to worshiping in the Catholic Church, and I wanted to do this because this is the response. Yeah. Is when they. Priest
at the end of the
complex
service every night,
the end of Vespers.
No, it's the after complex.
After complex. Sorry. The Mary Chapel.
And move over to the Mary Chapel, and basically it's an affirmation of your baptism, and as the fire comes round, just to the baptismal front. So.
Well, what other kind of usual common responses are there that we already use, like let's say at a concert or something where it's a very moving situation. And I guess I've been to concerts where a standing ovation has started by people simply standing up before there was any applause. A kind of respect for what has happened. This happens, I think, a lot in Minnesota. Minnesota has kind of a track record of people doing standing ovations, whether it's needed or not. I mean, I think it's to get the blood moving in their feet or something. Doesn't mean the performance was any good.
I was just thinking that sometimes I've heard that at a band concert when a really rousing march is played, now and then people will clap in rhythm with with the marching, which is, I think, the audience's wish to be involved.
In some places, people stamp their feet in rhythm.
Were you thinking in terms of performance? Response to performance?
We could start with that, but, you know,
movements,
I was thinking real kind of terms of motion. Because in church, you know, we also have a response system that we use, but we don't often study that very carefully, and sometimes it's like we stand up for the reading of the gospel, sometimes stand up for prayer, sometimes we sit down, sometimes we kneel. I mean, just our response through physical movement is a form of dance in my mind that we need to work on more carefully and think through and be sure that there's coherence between what we're doing and what we're trying to say or metaphorize.
This was before other people for this conference arrived here, but Sunday night with the Eucharist, as we were receiving, the choir was singing one of these South African freedom songs, and it was impossible not to move along with that music as you were standing in line coming up to receive.
That happened at the National Youth Gathering in San Antonio too, when we had Station Communion and the music in the band and the kids. Just in
driving,
in the bleachers as well as out on the field. It's just amazing, the movement and the energy in those young people. So it's contagious.
You know, this has nothing to do with worship, but I you're thinking about it, you're talking about it, makes me think the movement that I've seen lately on TV, and maybe if you've been up here at Holden, you haven't had the opportunity, but the response of the blacks in South Africa since the releasing of Mandela and seeing them jump in unison is the most remarkable thing to me. This huge crowd, they aren't all jumping, everyone.
The whole line in the streets.
All at once in unison, it's beautiful. And it isn't a funny jump, it's a springy jump, it's glorious.
I may be going way out on a limb, but I think that has everything to do with worship.
Yeah, it's joy.
I really do, and we know that our ancestors worshipped in movement. They danced to the gods. They danced for the rain. You all know these things. And I find it important that we begin to think that these things are not so separated out. I really do.
When we were doing our motions the other morning, and you were having a skip around the room, I was thinking, a choir procession, measured, careful, is the rational approach to getting from one place to another, the careful approach. So shouldn't we encourage choirs on festivals to skip down the
aisles? I think we should. I absolutely do. Yeah,
and really
skip around the stage. In our tradition, unfortunately, the way of serving communion is to people in the pews taking those trays of those awful shot glasses and everything. And it drove me crazy in my first church, where it didn't matter what else they got liturgically right, but the ushers or the deacons who were serving had to make sure that they walked lockstep. And how neat it would be if they took those elements and started, pirouetting with them and all that, take them out. At least it would give a better sense of the joy of the sacrament rather than everybody looking like they just lost their best friend.
Well, I had a hard time last night at Compline when we went into the Eucharist and we sang something on our knees.
Let us
break bread together on our knees. And I was sitting there thinking, why am I not getting down on my knees? And I looked around at everybody and said, oh, That's why I'm not getting down on my knees.
I didn't, because I don't believe in it. So.
Oh, Steve, you did that deliberately. No, I mean, it was such a wonderful moment and such a beautiful song, and it would have been, for me, just an absolutely blissful thing to just get down on my knees. I don't get down on my knees for much of anything anymore, but that would have felt so good to me in that moment. You have more things to say about ritual.
Well, in Northfield recently, we had the occasion to hear Robert Jensen talk to us a lot about what the essentials of worship are. It was in the context of studying communion. And he says that maybe we should start by thinking of worship as being essentially washing and blessing, hearing the word, although we shouldn't separate that from action in this context, or the other three, and eating together. All of those are such basic life activities. They're basic rituals we can build on. And we ought to key in on those first. And that's one reason I find it interesting to really think more and more about washing, because we've kind of avoided that one for a long time. And it deals with dirty things. And it deals with things that are uncomfortable. And it's worth thinking it through. Paul Tillich has said, I don't remember where, that people are not able to reinvent the basic spiritual symbolism. And I don't know if there's truth to that or not, but if you think of how long washing and eating and hearing the word have gone on without much change. I mean, it's changed in format and emphasis and style and flavor, but those things are pretty consistently there, and they're pretty consistently there in all of the Christian assemblies in the world. They're the things that unite us all, and they're the things that separate us from other reasons to assemble. You know, mm-hmm. for a concert or for a country club or for
football.
Kiwanis or
You know, one thing we haven't talked about very much is children in church. Uh-huh. Every other Sunday, I have 7 children in church, and I have the responsibility for trying to get them all to be perfect. You know, I mean, and when you got all those chairs that are straight and everybody's quiet and it's so stiff and kids are so normal and natural, you know, how are we going to be inclusive of kids in our worship? Or do we just leave them out?
Why are we so abnormal and unnatural?
I think movement and ritual is something that draws kids in. Mm-hmm. At our church, we give children's sermons every Sunday, and maybe not something I would choose to do, but it's something that is done there, so I do it. And I never cease to marvel that I always, or very often, end up relying on the very same thing we do all the time in church, and that is talk at the kids. Mm-hmm. And they learn, all of us learn in so many other ways, and that's part of what this is all about, how learning to take in more things with more of our senses and just talk. But I think kids notice movement, and they notice banners, and they notice processional crosses, and that will fill them with awe and wonder. When would people just file up for communion? It's something they notice. They also notice when they're excluded from that, too.
Mm-hmm. I can remember once when Andrew, are you awake?
Yes.
Remember in our church when Pastor Svensson came in and it was Peter the fisherman?
Mm-hmm.
Remember how that tickled you?
Yeah.
Just couldn't believe it? You couldn't figure out where his shoes were, where his pants went.
The guy.
He came in with a net over his shoulder, and he was Peter the fisherman for a while. And it was, you know, it was drama. But why not?
When I was in seminary, we went to Pilgrim Baptist Church in St. Paul one Sunday. The pastor there was doing some teaching at Luther, a couple courses, class I was in. So we decided to go there one Sunday morning, and with Andrea and Erica. We had two girls at the time. Andrea must have been 3 or 4. And we're there, and it was just an all black congregation, lots of talking in the pews, lots of amen. During the sermon, particularly, responses, it was a rhythm with the preacher. And little Andrea standing on the pew and leaning over the pew in front of us, between a couple of women that are in there about 60 each. You know, everybody's talking. Little Andrea's going, "Praise the Lord! Thanks be to God!" and one of us, just as we do in our church, and just without even thinking, just kind of put our hand on her shoulder. And the woman in front said, "You don't have to ever do that in this church," she said. Wow. I just sort of sunk back down. And Andrew just smiled.
Well, of course, Tom, as I was talking about the other day, I mean, we've been doing this to kids, and it's been done to us ever since we were 2 or 3, which is why the thought of moving in a service is pretty tough. And why, when we come into a situation like this, we sit tight. I remember last summer when I was doing a lecture session here, I invited the people who were attending it to not do that, to somehow, during the lecture time, stand up a couple of times, change chairs, skip around the room. I mean, to really, really let themselves do what the body might suggest would be comfortable. And nobody did, except one lovely two older women who had been coming to some of my other sessions, and they just got up and skipped around the room and sat back down and were very concerned that no one else did that. I mean, I'm not suggesting necessarily that that's what we need to do in a worship service, but it is something that I think is a social problem we have.
I think it's a fair question in planning worship, though. What kind of movement will there be in this service of worship for everybody this time? I think it's a fair question to ask and to look at.
Well, and as we, what do we do in a service? We walk in. I mean, we're greeted. We walk in. We sit down. We stand up to pray, or we sit down to pray, or we stand up to sing. We sit down. In some churches, people kneel. In some churches, there's genuflection. In some churches, there's making the sign of the cross. We get up. We walk out. Now, sometimes to pass the peace. That's another thing we do, too.
But
go ahead. No, that's fine.
All of these things that a church is doing, is their ritual. You don't have non-ritual churches and ritual churches. Mm-hmm. All of these things are the ritual. So it's a question of deciding intelligently whether or not they represent something, and if they are making sense for what you are celebrating or what you are trying to communicate. As I was speaking, you know, the other day about the pastor who carefully tries not to be obvious but is in the spotlight just walking around the chancel, that is an extraordinary dance for self-attention under being the guise of being non-liturgical. But you could, that is a ritual act, you see. And we just seem to have to be aware of what we are doing all the time and try to make these things connected with the religious acts that are under the surface that they're trying to represent so that they have meaning to people. And we just I think we've lost a lot of this kind of capacity to
bubble.
Express ourselves and bubble and be spirited in church. I have. That's one reason I'm interested in it, because I came to a background where, you know, I'm very unemotional in church about these things.
And you all may think I do it, but I don't. I'm as scared to death of it as you are. Mm-hmm. I've come into it from a whole different place. But you think I wasn't concerned about what we were doing tonight? I didn't know whether it was going to work or not.
Well, Steve mentioned knowing what it means, and I think that's what one of the things that people are afraid of. Our church hosted just this past month, in January, an ecumenical service for the beginning of the week of Prayer for Christian Unity. And that is a service, at least the one we used, was one that was published by an ecumenical institute, I think in Gaylord. And it's a lovely service of readings and prayers. But it suggested that the service begin with the representatives of the various denominations, and we had six, come together with pitchers of water and pour them into the font collectively, and then for the person doing the next part of the liturgy to do precisely what Lisa did. And the Roman Catholics thought it was great, and the Lutherans thought it was great, but some of the others were afraid of what they might think their people would interpret it being, and that would be rebaptism. Mm. And so there we would have been doing something that for some folks would have been very normal, but for others would have meant something else. And so we excluded it from the service. But had we done it the way you did, I think it was very clear what was going on with that at the end, even if we had come in here uninitiated. And so I think that's a very important thing. What we do has to be grounded in something that's meaningful.
You should not just be doing acts that are done mm-hmm. as right. acts. They must be grounded
right.
in a base.
So I was thinking as this was happening, this is how I want to do it next year. When we have that service.
She'll send you the
I was thinking exactly the same thing on the second day of the clock.
Are there other comments? Or we seem to be doing most of the talking up here. I suppose we were a panel and we're supposed to do that.
Well, you have some things you want to finish up, and I know that David has some things he wants to say.
I have one message from a Roman Catholic, Romano Gardini, who dealt with the recent reforms in the Catholic liturgies. And as they struggled with a lot of significant changes over the last 15 years, he made the statement that we must recognize and deal with the religious acts underlying the liturgy. And he wondered, through all their discussions of change, whether in fact it is possible for us today to rediscover, quote, a whole world of acts which have become atrophied. Might be a survival question about the church. And that is not a statement that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater and junk our liturgical heritage. It's another statement. I'll toss the ball over to you.
There's a marvelous statement. Can I see this book, Phyllis?
Mm-hmm.
That she makes in the introduction.
Is that about the intuition? I don't know which one you're looking for.
I didn't bring my book down.
It's okay.
But she was referring to the so-called right brain, left brain split.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Want me to look for it? I think I know where it is.
Well, you're looking from that. I was recently reading, and many of you, those of you who study a lot here at Holden, can fill this in, but I understand that I think it's Yale and Cornell have both now developed tests for numerous kinds of intelligence besides a verbal cognitive intelligence. Visual intelligence, oral intelligence, kinesthetic intelligence, which means, I guess, that's athletics.
Of course, yes.
But Yale and Cornell will still allow in people of one particular thing.
Probably. So maybe there's hope that we'll begin to recognize other realities of our being.
Did you find it?
Yeah, I did. Judith Rock writes the introduction to this book, and it's written after the book is basically finished. But she, in talking about her quest to recapture the intuitive in worship, she says that the call to reintegrate the rational, that is the cognitive part, the thinking part, and intuitive parts of ourselves is coming from all sides. Recent research has shown us the right hemisphere of the brain as the nonverbal and intuitive side, and the left hemisphere as the verbal and rational side. But according to Ann Wilson Schaaf, The newest research suggests that most functional thinking occurs during the synergistic action, that means working together, of both hemispheres and the brain stem. This union produces especially clear and powerful thinking that is far superior to linear rational thinking. In other words, we need to try every way we can to recapture that part of learning, because we're really deprived people in this culture. Ever since the Enlightenment, we've learned to think of the rational, provable, verifiable, reproducible fact as the only thing that really is important. And everything else we acknowledge as existing, but is certainly not very important, and in fact becomes in a matter of private domain and private kind of interpretation, and therefore no longer even part of public discourse. Pat Kiefer talks about that in terms of the fact on one side and value split. And this is a cry to bring those together again. And I think we'll be wholer, richer people for that. I mean, just think of the times we've seen psalms or other parts of the worship danced as well as read, and how much more meaningful that is, and how much more memorable it is. We learn with all of our faculties, not just hearing rational speech. And the Lutheran Church is partly at fault in that, because we are so word-oriented, and we would never give it up. I wouldn't give that up. The word is specific, and in the end we need the specificity of that, but we can't do that at the expense of the ambiguous. One of the questions I asked Phyllis last night when she finally told us how she was going to start this was basically, she used the so-called flood prayer from the baptismal rite.
Slightly rewritten.
Reworked it a little bit. I said, why do you feel the need to have the word there? And that's a good question. It's possible without the text that it would get so far out that it wouldn't mean anything anymore, and we would all have our own meanings.
It had been not to have any verbal, to have nothing verbal at all. It was to have been a totally nonverbal experience. And in contemplating this, we had talked about the idea via phone before we came here. I began talking to a bunch of people in Seattle. Went to a minister there to check out the whole. You know, this is, I get concerned that I'm going way off on, out on cloud nine, and needed to get a little grounded. And one of, it was one of my art friends, drama friends, who suggested words as a balance, or as, maybe she was thinking in terms of the grounding exactly. She didn't say it that way. And we played around with all kinds of things, the thought of just talking about water. Reading from the encyclopedia about water, just some kind of droning, mm-hmm. verbal sound, so that people would have that to hang on to, maybe. And I was really unhappy about that. And then when David suggested the flood prayer, written by Luther, it sounded perfect. But there were a few things that didn't feel right to me in the prayer, so we did make a few changes.
There are common things that we do in the culture that are ambiguous. Think about an embrace or a kiss. Does that always mean only one thing? What about Judas's kiss of Jesus in the garden? Or what about drinking a cup? Does that always mean communion? What about Socrates' death? So that's why the Lutheran would never let go of the word. But I'm suggesting we certainly could enrich the word with a lot.
With that, I graduated from seminary about 13 years ago, and either you, Dave, or Carol. How is the seminary being helpful in this whole type of conversation we're having tonight? I know that the planning of worship and liturgy, the whole thing, doesn't fall only on clergy, but I think there can be they can help to speed along, to help or hinder what we're talking about.
At LNTS, at least, that's what Lutheran Northwestern, the worship area is getting strengthened. Mons Teig is there and is very good, and we'll now have a full-time, full-fledged musician, theologian on staff in the person of Paul Westermeyer, who's first rate. He's both a pastor and musician. And the two of them will kind of be the core of the worship program and start to plan worship in an integrated way. It's been kind of the pastor who's assigned to do the preaching for the morning, and they have worship every day. They're does the whole service with very little consultation with the campus pastor or anything. So it's kind of a hodgepodge. And I think they'll do it much more deliberately now, with much greater emphasis on the importance of that rather than have it be an incidental thing.
I'd be interested in knowing, since this was billed and it's kind of done as a what you call a performance, I'd just be intrigued to know what kind of responses or interactions people. It's kind of a vague question, but just whether it was involving, so that even though it was a performance, you felt like you were participating in some way in what was going on. Because in a way, we can be passive and participate in events. And I'm just curious how people felt that they were participating in what was going on here. If I can ask such a private thing.
How did you use the word passive? You said we can be passive and participate. What did you mean?
Passive in that we weren't moving.
Okay.
Or speaking. Or
okay.
Our minds apparently working.
Right.
For those who were awake.
Okay.
For me, it was several things going on. We have a little bit of movement that goes on in our church service, but not very much, and it's pretty, set. And this was a very free, flowing kind of thing. And for me, it's a learning experience. This whole thing has been, taking a look at what I consider my boundaries and what I find comfortable and uncomfortable, and what works and what doesn't work. So in part, there's sort of a mind play of, do I like this? Do I not like this? Am I comfortable with this? Does this make sense? Then there's another part, the words at the beginning helped give me a place to begin from and to explore from that. Now, what does this mean? And how does this feel with my understanding of God and with water and all these different things and the washing of the feet? So there's more than one thing going on for me in watching it. It would be nice to get to a point where I was so used to it, it was such an acceptable thing that I could then just relax into the medium and then see how I perceived it or how I felt about it. But there's more than that going on right now for me.
I'm more of an audio person than a visual person, and I really enjoyed the sound, the natural sound of the water, the tape. To me, that really made what I was seeing come together. Also, I really enjoyed watching Byron as he was watching Gary very lovingly handle Byron's wife.
What? I missed that.
Well, I had to really work. We did have to tone that down a little bit.
You should have seen the original.
Right. No, it was wonderful. I cannot tell you what a joy it was to work with all these people because, they did their own stuff. I didn't really, I gave them a few ideas and they did their own stuff. And it was wonderful to see Jeannie in the beginning when we first worked on that, and I really wanted the hair and the oil, and she was so into that it was as if she were making love to the foot with her hands and her hair, and I really didn't feel we could quite handle that yet. So we had to do a little bit of pulling back on that.
She resents that. Has she wanted to do that?
Oh, is there really a rigid line, though, between performance and the things that we normally do in liturgy? I mean, because you're talking about passivity on the part of the congregation. Isn't the congregation, in a sense, just as passive or just as involved by a sermon or when the choir sings, choir anthem or whatever?
I think that's exactly right. We, in fact, move from state to state. Yeah. We may. We're not in one state all the time.
Right? Yeah, but I think there is a difference because I know when choir anthems degenerate into mere performance, and sermons can degenerate into that too. But there really is some sort of gray area there where there's, you know.
That's a real good question to struggle with. Like in the Lutheran Book of Worship, the Green Book, there is no place for an anthem. That was cut out on purpose, so there wasn't a performance spot in the liturgy, right? Mm-hmm. As I understand it. Mm-hmm. Although most churches try to kind of work it in somehow. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you guys wouldn't be employed, right?
the intent is to have whatever's in the service have a natural part of it, not an incidental one.
Like time out for some entertainment.
Right.
I just think it's rather.
I don't know.
It's unfair to criticize some things as performance when really they're performance.
Well, I think that's exactly right. So I don't think we should feel bad when we say something was maybe performance oriented. We should look at what that word means. It carries some bad connotations with it. Because I guess I wouldn't want to classify what happened tonight really as performance-oriented, necessarily. Because I think maybe we don't need to use that terminology at all. We have such a need to classify everything, right?
But when you leave a service of worship, I don't like to think that my congregation leaves on a Sunday with the reading chart. You know, they're checking things off. But
we're going to stop hanging those numbers. And those numbers you hold up in the bag. Do you know if you're going to have
waivers? Came home once and the parsonage was for sale. But what would you say when you've left any particular services of worship, what for you has been a meaningful service of worship? In the definitions that came earlier, in terms of praise and thanksgiving to God and everything else. But what is that?
Are you looking directly at me?
Oh. I have one eye on you and a half an eye on you and a half an eye on you. Actually, all three of you, if you could, just briefly. Because you represent three different disciplines in some way.
Ask it once again, Tom. What
when you leave a service of worship on a Sunday morning, what what has happened in the service of worship that would lead you to say, this was a good service of worship today?
You'll want to go first while I think.
Sure. I'll just say whatever comes to mind here. I mean, there are a lot of different circumstances, but I guess I feel like I've been part of a group effort at praise and thanksgiving and celebration and get some rewards from that when there's communion. When something has been preached probably less than 12 minutes that has said, tried to amplify the gospel in new ways that kind of say, I never understood that or and does not have a whole lot of religious talk, just kind of straight language. Because I've been around churches so long, I really have a hard time with kind of God talk stuff. I actually just do it. That's my own problem. It's like I've been around churches so long that when the Lord's Prayer starts, I start yawning. And I have a physiological reaction to the Lord's Prayer, and I won't yawn as soon as it starts. I don't know the reason for that. But I think mostly those things that in kind of an aesthetic sense about what's happened, if there's really a sense of kind of an artistic hole in the service, that makes a lot of difference to me. If there's been a lot of interruption, if there's been discontinuity, if there's been a lot of kind of dissonance. I don't mean things that jar a person or are different, but just things that don't fit. Mm-hmm. That kind of gets me out of the sense that it all added up to something.
I guess I have a very personal, very, very, very personal response to that question, Tom, and I'm not sure I'm exactly, well, I guess I end up in the area of, I want to feel that I've been energized. I want to feel that I've been engaged in body, mind, spirit. That I have been given something fascinating to think about, or maybe something comforting to think about, or something sad to think about, but something that maybe I really need to attend to. I want to feel physically energized, either through the singing, or what's been said, or what activity I've had, which might have worked if I'd been able to kneel last night. I mean, I'm not suggesting... it just felt so right.
You're a literalist.
Oh, really?
Yes.
See, you're calling me a name.
Yes. You can, don't have to kneel to
well,
kneel.
I know you don't have to kneel to kneel, except sometimes it's nice to kneel to kneel, okay?
But Phyllis, you want people to do something spontaneous in your sessions, but yet you're not prepared to do something spontaneous and complex.
Sure. I'm a complex human being, Robert. Okay?
I wish you'd knelt.
No, but you see, that it's the whole matter of permission. What kind of environment has been established? Do I have permission to do that? I try in my sessions to give you all permission to do these things. I mean, that's the point of the session. But I don't know what permission I have to do. I mean, that's the whole, I mean, these are the issues we've been talking about. But I think the other thing that I wanted to answer to you, Tom, and then I'm going to let
break new ground.
is what Steve said, the whole notion of feeling that I've been engaged in something with other people, and I want to leave a worship service feeling that my heart has been opened, that I am able to think in more loving ways, live in more loving ways, work in more loving ways, move in more loving ways, whatever that means, okay?
Well, I'm a good Lutheran, and I always want to feel convicted. I do. If I can go to a worship and haven't been convicted, something's wrong. And I don't know whose fault it is, if it's mine, if I haven't heard the word, or if the word wasn't preached. But then there I'm talking about the preaching again. But I want to feel convicted, and I want to feel forgiven, or know that I've been forgiven, and I want the community. That's something that you folks are talking about. Not only the fellowship of community, but also the responsibility that being part of community entails. So, I'll jump ahead to one writer that I'm going to talk about tomorrow, who defines worship for him, at least his model is in three parts, having to do with preaching. That's both law and gospel. That's the conviction and the forgiveness and the sacrament, of course. And then what he calls koinonia, fellowship, and the uplifting of the community, to the community. And then what he calls liturgia, worship, praise, which is the Greek word that liturgy comes from. So I guess if I haven't had all three of those things, the preaching, which is law and gospel, the community, and praise and thanksgiving, prayer, praise and thanksgiving, then it hasn't been complete for me. And as much as I love having worship services when both sacraments are celebrated, I guess I'm and I really would go that way if I could. I don't have to have had the sacraments to feel it's complete. I think but I have placed so much emphasis on the sacramentality of the word itself. But that's my Lutheran bias, Steve. So, did you mean to say that if you haven't had communion here, it hasn't been so satisfactory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
You know, in regard to tonight's service, one of the reasons that it's seemed like it succeeded, not to speak conceptually here, because I was a performer rather than an observer, but let me speculate what it felt like to an observer, is that it falls in Steve's area as the space, that it worked because of this space. The congregation could not be completely passive. They were involved because of from sprinkling, if nothing else, but everything was going on here. If we were doing these same things, these little vignettes, in a bus church, where our things were way up in the chancel, it would have really been a performance. And I would have gone leaving feeling empty, and you know that was a waste of my time.
Inseparable issues. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Glad you said that. Thanks.
The first vision of this service that came was that of doing an extremely formal ritual of washing the feet of Christ. And I had first thought of three men standing in the pit, symbolizing Christ and the two others on the crosses, and they sustaining and holding the body that was going to have the feet washed. And then I was seeing the three Marys as coming and actually doing the foot washing. And I do not believe that would have worked in this space. I think that something like that might work in a bus church. But the more I had forgotten, even though I was here last summer, I'd forgotten how huge this thing is. Yeah. I really had. I was shocked.
I have a question about worship and how we're approaching it. I don't know if it's a question, if it's a statement, or a wondering. When you're talking about when you feel satisfied, then you come out of worship and a question. Maybe because at one point I had walked away from the church and said, it's only hypocrites that go there, you know, and I'm not going there, and then later on decided I better join up. You know, from that perspective. But to me, worship is an opportunity. You know, we do all these things to allow for opportunities of unguarded moments. And I haven't heard yet where God's doing his part in all of these different things. You know, that I think they're all important, but I think they allow for those unguarded moments where the pastor mm-hmm. does wonderful sermons, but sometimes it's not a sermon that gets me. Mm-hmm. We have people that sing beautifully. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's not that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a person sitting in front of me with a disabled child who's slobbering down the shoulder mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. reminds me mm-hmm. of the messiness of Christ dying on the cross for me. Mm-hmm. And that's an unguarded moment. That's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And isn't that what we do, is create opportunities?
That's right.
It's not a...
And they're built-in contradictions and... Mm-hmm. And unpredictabilities.
If we forget, that's what we're doing. I think sometimes we put more power in the actual rituals or the in the way the space looks. Or and I think those are important. But I think there's a whole other movement that is totally separate from us.
Mm-hmm. But the chief ritual, you could say, is the fact that everyone comes together. Because you would miss those opportunities
mm-hmm.
if
right.
you did not assemble.
That mm-hmm. mm-hmm. they yeah. are opportunities.
Yeah. It doesn't happen on the television set.
If I could share just for a second, my own personal vision is that Jesus wasn't a worshiper, he was a party man. You know. And I think if he was here today, that his number one emphasis of the church is to mission to the world. And you know, equalize what's happening in terms of the distribution of the goods that this earth has for us. I think that would be his number one purpose in life. And I think our worship should somehow have that in mind. And when we plan worship, it's got to be leading up to Jesus' real purpose. I mean, that's my point.
But it's that service that reminds me of what Christ did for me that gives me the freedom to do that very thing.
The other historic meaning of liturgy was the work of the people of God. And mm-hmm. so implied in the service must be what is the mission mm-hmm. of this group. It can't be just for its own sake.
I think Luther's words in the third article tie in with not just worship, but they do tie in with what we're talking about with worship, with the Holy Spirit calling and then gathering and uniting and then making holy. And to me, it's not a making holy period, it's a making holy da-da-dat, or for something. And then that servanthood for going out again. I just think that those four words, to me, sum up in some ways the purpose of worship as well.
But, you know, I think we should talk about your comment more, because how do you see ways that can really be made evident in church? Because churches have been so afraid to be political.
Well, you have to put your mind where your mouth is. You know, the whole... Yeah. Identity of the church has to be what our function is, and to me, and I think what we've been working to develop at our church in the last few years is a sense of ownership of the idea that what our purpose is to mission to the world, and you know, it's got to be more than just worship. I think worship is really probably third or fourth priority in our church now.
Are you saying that's a should or an is?
I believe it is. A lot of people don't even come. But then whenever we have a meeting, all these faces pop up. We have people that hang out in the narthex during communion and talk about football. Okay? And everybody looks out there and they can see them. Okay, but these are people who are really involved uh-huh. in what happens with our church. So
I would hope that the ideal would be that the community would be together for all of those.
Well, I think that's optimal. Everybody's got their own thing. Yeah. But it is really nice. Like, for instance, now we have a homeless apartment in our church. We were the first one in our area that did this. Now there's a bunch of other churches that are starting to do this as well. We've decided one of our identities is the resettlement of refugee families. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the blessings that are coming back to the church just from starting to implement some of these ideas are unbelievable. And this is what's going to draw people into your church. You could have total Zen worship experience, you know, where everybody just comes in, yeah, big deal. You know, there's a needy world out there.
Yeah. I don't know, I just sort of feel that worship in this sense of mystic union and that comes from the creation of this corporate becoming the body of Christ is what feeds that.
Well, I think so too, but what does Jesus say? He said, hey, don't look for me in heaven if you haven't met the needs of the people around you. Mm-hmm. Forget it.
Yeah, but it's
but I need to be grounded in worship where I can be reminded and hear that word of Christ. Mm-hmm. To me, to gather there and hear that.
But I still think it should only that, you know, you still got to put your money where your mouth is, that's all.
Yeah. They're not exclusive of each other.
Amos speaks to that real clear. Yeah.
They are, if they use Jan's song that she taught us all.
Yeah.
Yes, they would be.
Folks, I have the sense... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Tom.
I was just saying, Mons Teague, in the book that you lent me, said that if you want to see how your mission statement in your congregation has been lived out in worship the last couple of years, go through the last 2 years and look at the hymns that you've chosen to sing as one way to do that. Yeah. Worship ties in with your statement of mission in the congregation. Mm.
Yeah, I was thinking after today, I thought, I want to get my hands on ever-flowing streams.
and do a rhetorical content analysis of that book. So, I don't know. I may move on to that. So, but it didn't occur to me until I was well into this, not nearly in time for me to have looked at it.